Free Energy Now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see a past lineup of speakers and see who's coming down the pike and download some past shows. We do put our shows onto an archive where you can retrieve them there. Also, if you're listening live, you get some phone numbers there if you want to call in with some questions. We typically do ask that you wait to the end of the show to call in. And today is Labor Day in the United States, September 1st, 2008, and is early in the morning in Australia, where Phil Hardcastle is located. He's joining us from down under to talk about his rotating thermionic generator concept. This relies on centrifugal forces to create a biased electric flow by lowering the work function of the emitter to a fraction of a volt, so you have super high amperage, very low voltage, very similar to the homopolar or Faraday disc concept. He believes his design could provide all the energy needs of the world just from ambient air. Now, of course, there's a prototype that needs to be built. We'll be talking about that. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You're certainly welcome. I should mention that I was talking with Phil on a conference call yesterday, actually 2 days ago, with one of our associates from the New Energy Congress. And when I did pass this concept, somebody sent me an email suggesting that we cover this at PezWiki.com. I forwarded it to the New Energy Congress Technology Screening Committee, and I got some pretty good thumbs up on it was a worthwhile concept worth pursuing. And so we did create a feature page, and those of us, those who are listening in, you're welcome to go to that page at PezWiki.com, where you can see some pictures and whatnot. And Philip has actually gone in and spent quite a bit of time in helping out with that page so that it's written accurately. He's added some descriptions and whatnot. So we may also refer to some pictures that are on that page. So again, why don't you go ahead and we welcome you to the show, Phil, and give us a bit of a description, give us an overview, and I think maybe even rather than going straight into the technology, tell us a little bit about your background, kind of your skeptic bone and whatnot.
Sure. My background has been very varied. I was in the Australian Navy as a naval officer, and I did electrical engineering at the University of New South Wales, and then worked in various technologies and some consumer electronics. For instance, I was the inventor of the pulse control, although the listed patent holder is a Japanese guy, but in actual fact, I showed him how to make it work. But anyway, I then went on to become a geophysicist with Exxon, Alesso, Australia, in this parallel world. Did all exploration, and later on I opened up a coal mine surveying equipment company where I designed guidance systems for coal mine drilling. So in many ways I've been in the employ of the other side of the fossil fuel industry. But many years ago, just shortly after university, I was working in the jungle of Sumatra, and
Let me jump in here really quick. I need to have you back away from the mouthpiece on your phone so that we get a better audio quality. It's coming across too strong.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right, so hopefully that's better. So anyway, I vowed to try and find a solution for third world people in terms of electricity production, and later on vowed to try and find a solution for the fact that the world was entering into a very difficult period of climate change. One of the things I was aware of course, was the second law of thermodynamics, a law that basically said that you can't get power from ambient air, and you must have a temperature differential. And I certainly respected that, even though I sort of vowed 30 years ago, that I would keep on trying until I found something. And 5 years ago, I was working on more conventional technology, Stirling engines and so forth, thermoacoustic engines, looking at the viability, economic viability of these for African villages. And when I came upon an idea, and that idea initially I dismissed because it went up against the second law of thermodynamics. But after a couple of sleepless nights, I realized that I'd almost overlooked the most important small detail, which I can imagine a million scientists before me could have easily overlooked as well, had they been looking at that particular issue. And so the rotating thermionic generator basically is to take the principle of the standard thermionic generator, which says that you have an emitter and a collector and a temperature differential, which causes the electrons to flow from the emitter to the collector. If the collector gets hot, then the electrons also try to flow from the collector to the emitter. So in a standard thermionic generator, you have to cool the collector to make it work. And the point is that 90% of the heat that you put into a standard thermionic generator is wasted. So the thing was with the idea to use centrifuge, the centrifugal acceleration, to cause a bias flow. So the emitter is the rotor, and it spins very, very fast. In fact, almost to the point of metal destruction. And when it spins very, very fast, all the electrons, the free electrons within that disk, are being forced outwards to the edge of the rotor. And when those electrons at the edge of the rotor are being so pressured, if one electron has sufficient kinetic energy, in other words, the heat of that electron is sufficiently high, it will jump off the disk. And as it jumps off the disk, as opposed to normal conventional thermionics, it is now finding that the spot that it left is being filled by the pressure of the electrons being pushed outwards. And so this effectively reduces the amount of work that an electron has to do to get off the disk. On the other side, the collector, because we're talking about the device operating at near ambient temperature, or even below ambient temperature, there is no emission, or virtually no emission. It's sort of like one emission every 10 hours. So there's no issue of a backflow. So we have a very clear biased flow from the emitter to the collector without having a temperature differential. And if we have no temperature differential, we have no heat loss. Now, the point is that when that electron jumps off the rotor, it's one of the more energetic electrons. In other words, the average temperature of electrons may be room temperature, but there's a tremendous spectrum of scope at those temperatures, some very much hotter and some significantly cooler. So this tends to be a selective process. The most energetic ones jump off, but at 0.3 electron volt of work function, I'll come to that in a second, but at a very small work function, there's still an incredible number of electrons that want to jump off. In fact, far more than we possibly need. So this work function, this is the amount of work that an electron must do to escape a surface. When it's 5 volts, which is the normal value for a static piece of metal, no electron can escape at room temperature. You have to get the temperature up to 1,500 degrees C plus before you can start to get any significant number of electrons having sufficient energy to jump over that high wall, if you will. But this rotating disk very rapidly, it's as though it lowers the bar significantly. And so we now get a very large number of electrons, the more energetic ones, that are able to get off the disk. And when they get get off the disk, they leave behind a positive charge. And those electrons that are off the disk, they can migrate back to the inside of the disk to replace themselves. But in the meantime, there is a positive charge created in the plate, which means that there is a voltage created across the plate that will want to suck electrons from the center back to the outer. And what I've done is I've used the Faraday motor, the homopolar motor, to utilize that current flow, which is at very, very, very high currents, to use that current to induce a torque in the disk. So when electrons are getting off, using work to get off, they're also creating a potential. So energy is neither created nor destroyed, it's simply converted from a kinetic energy to a potential energy. A current flows through the disk, it induces a torque, the disk goes faster. Obviously, the electron jumping off at the edge of the disk had a kinetic energy of the heat plus the kinetic energy of the rotational speed of the disk. What I calculated and found was that the amount of energy required to replace the kinetic energy of the peripheral speed of the disk was 1/100,000th of the energy that the electron would do in escaping the surface. So it was not just over unity, it was 100,000 times over unity. And so we have this incredible situation that electrons are jumping off, which means energy's been converted, kinetic energy's been converted to potentially been converted to torque, and the torque of the disk can then run a standard generic generator. But importantly, the disk must have gotten colder. If we are converting heat into torque, into rotation, into agility, the disk must be getting colder. So the actual fact that it's not a perpetual motion machine, it sucks in heat from the outside world. And if you want kilowatts, you have to have square meters of disk. However, because the device is 100% efficient, we can, in actual fact, using standard two-stage compressors and expansion turbines, a bit like a jet engine, we can actually ramp up the temperature of ambient air by compressing it hundreds of times to 1,000 degrees. That then transmits an incredible amount of radiant energy to a relatively small disk. And so we can, a device a bit larger than, say, a hat box, produce 50 kilowatts from ambient air, and that equates to an inflow to the compressor of about 2 cubic meters per second. The air, having gone through what I call the universal RTG, then goes through an expansion turbine to recover the compressed energy. And that basically completes the cycle. It's a very simple device. It's never been proposed before. In fact, I could find no reference whatsoever to even spinning a disc for the first year, and eventually came across some work, although not actually related to the physics that I'm talking about, but certainly proving that electrons can be centrifuged.
Now, in your design, as I look at it, you're talking about a central X-shaped thing that's X-shaped in the cross-sectional view that is spinning at a super high speed, and the electrons are coming off the periphery of that cycle. You know, I have to admit that in this particular technology, I am not very knowledgeable, and so I may sound like an ignoramus in some of my questions. I apologize in advance for that. But when you're describing electrons coming off the edges of these and then being harvested, my brain is asking, where are the electrons being replenished from? How are you creating a flow of electrons? Because certain elements require a certain combination of protons and electrons to stay stable. And if you're bleeding off electrons, then you're creating instability. So there has to be a replenishment of electrons from somewhere. Where is that somewhere in this case?
Well, the electrons that come off the rotor, there's two pictures on the website, as you can see. There's one which is referred to as a an RPG with a vacuum return, and that we can imagine that rather than being a disc with a spindle, we can imagine it as being a ring upon a spindle, but essentially it's a ring, so it's got an inner and outer surface, and a sure vacuum return path. So electrons that jump off the outside of the ring can migrate and just travel gently around in the vacuum until they come upon the inside of the ring where they can be sucked in. Now, in the case of the other drawings, what I show there is the outer emitter, the collector, and then an inner emitter, a secondary emitter, which is made of ultra-fine spin tips, basically a field array which is incredibly sharp. So we're talking nanopoints, and that allows, at a very small bias, if the distance is relatively small, a very small voltage to allow non-contact transfer. Now, just recently, I've revised this idea and gone with a South African University idea that at very, very short ranges, a diamond coating, CDD deposited coating, can exhibit superconductive characteristics. So the future design is looking at trying to have a surface, and it has to be on the flat rather than on the curve, but a surface very, very close of CVD to the rotor, allowing the return path. Now, originally, homopolar motors had brushes, and brushes generated a lot of heat and so forth, and obviously brushes also degrade, and this whole system operates in a very high vacuum, so brushes of that type, A, would cause a tremendous amount of drag, and B, it would pollute the vacuum. However, for a prototype or for a proof of concept using a vacuum feed-through, I'm proposing to make a much simpler return path, and that is simply a bath of mercury. So the electrons off the rotor are collected into the metal of the body of the device, and then the body of the device at the center spindle has a bowl of mercury the center spindle goes into, then the center spindle passes through a vacuum seal back into the main body and to the rotor, so completing the path.
Okay. Now, in terms of, let's talk for a minute here, you're describing a disk that is going at a very high speed, and even if you have very little resistance, it still takes energy to get a body moving. So there's an input energy required to keep that body in motion. How much is that part of the equation, the amount of energy required to keep that generator turning, compared to the amount of energy that is coming off, some of which could then be used to keep the thing spinning?
Yeah. Well, in terms of bearings, that's a fairly negligible amount because obviously we're choosing a fairly small value of radius of the bearings because of that speed. Inherently, we couldn't have large bearings. We'd probably want to go to a magnetic suspension bearing. But in terms of the actual disc traveling in vacuum, the vacuum that I'm wishing for in a commercial model is in excess of 10 to the minus 8 torr. So we're looking at a pretty high vacuum, and if it gets as installed, it may go as high as 10 to the minus 10. So what we're talking about is essentially a drag a million times less than if it were done in air. Whatever drag does occur, of course, creates some minor triboelectric or heating effect, and that's, of course, not a loss in the design where we have no heat exhaust. As to the general principle of getting a disc up to speed, of course, it is a flywheel. And that actually works very much in our favor because the device can contain a couple of kilowatt hours of energy. But once it's up to speed, of course, it's generating power. The replacement energy, kinetic energy for electrons, as I said before, is 1/100,000th of the energy converted from the electrons, escaping electrons, to torque. So we're talking about a microscopic loss. So overall, yes, we have to supply energy for the first 5 minutes. So the simplest way of doing that is to have the generator, which is attached to the grid, so act as a synchronous motor, to bring the disc up to speed. Once the disc is within the operating speed band, it starts acting to generate power. And because of the kinetic energy of the flying rotor, if there is a sudden large demand for power, in actual fact, the rotor can provide some of that demand. So we have a device that, for argument's sake, in a domestic application, could be putting out 3 kilowatts. But if instantaneously you wanted to turn on a toaster, a jug, an electric heater, and so forth, the unit could supply it by virtue of using some of its flywheel energy. Of course, if the speed drops below a given point, the unit no longer is in power production. But when it's connected to the grid, it will always be trying to go in advance of the grid and therefore to act as a generator.
So in practice, this generator would not be one that you could govern up and down to give more or less output, but you'd kind of want it to be at a constant output level.
No, I think the situation is that the device will operate a bit like if you were a gasoline engine. If you give it more fuel, heat, it will try and work harder. So for a situation now, for argument's sake, if you built one with a compressor and an expansion turbine and wanted to run a truck or an auto with it, then essentially the accelerator would be, of course, connecting the output to electric motors and so forth. But also, you can choke down the operation by restricting the amount of inflow. So at all times, really, the system has distinct similarities to any power generation system. You can shut it down, and that's an important factor, of course. You can shut it down very quickly by simply depriving it of incoming heat. I don't see an issue in terms of its capability to handle high loads. I don't see a difficulty with the unit operating at steady loads and so forth. And in fact, really, it's probably true to say that for maximum economic value, one would have the thing operating, but like a diesel generator, operating at what is considered 70% load all the time, and the design would take that into account. And I say the design, there is a very large amount of current flowing in a homopolar disc and flowing out at the edge of the rotor, and one wouldn't want to exceed the design characteristics for too long. Otherwise, some of these very, very fine tips of the rotor could be ablated by the tremendous electron counts flowing past them. So in normal consideration, it will run 100 years at the design load, and for 10% of the time, you could operate at 10 times the design load. So it's a tremendously flexible thing, and especially if you're talking about as an automotive device, it's perfect for going down the highway at cruise speed, and yet at the same time, it's fantastic for overtaking a double-length truck. I see no problem with it in its applications.
So I could see from an engineering point of view that this kind of design would work fine in a stationary perspective. You've got this super high rotation with a vacuum space to prevent resistance inside the rotor portion. But as soon as you talk about a moving body, a car, other transportation vehicle, and this is providing the power for it, you've got bumps in the road. It's going to be jostled and jarred, and you've got the gyroscopic effect also to create torque on the this thing as it's wanting to stay in one position while the vehicle is turning left and right and sideways and back and forth and uphill, downhill. Wouldn't that present a problem for a transportation scenario?
Well, as you rightly said, it's like a gyroscope, and in fact, gyroscopes are used in aircraft, they're used in all sorts of devices, and the gimbal for that reason. The precession of a gyroscope, of course, as you rightly say, if you have a spinning rotor very hardly fastened to the chassis and you want to turn right, you might end up turning in some slightly different direction. However, You can also have contra rotation, in other words, you can have two devices back to back, and you can have gimbaling. These issues, in fact, can work in your advantage. I do note that there is a gyroscope stabilization system for boats to take out the rocking action of a boat. It could be argued that designed in a particular way, it may stop a car leaning as it goes around the corner. However, I mean, talking general principles, if the device is operating at 1200 degrees Kelvin, the rotor is no longer a meter or so diameter. In fact, we're talking 30 centimeter diameter. And whilst it's spinning very, very fast and has a high gyroscopic effect compared to the mass of a motor vehicle, I don't see it causing the vehicle to roll over or even noticeably deflect. But I'll leave that to Ford and General Motors to work out the fine details. But certainly gimbaling is an appropriate way of handling this. So one would imagine under the hood there would be this device on a couple of freedom of motion gimbals.
Now, when you're talking about high speed, just how high are we talking about in the speed of rotation for operation and the window that we're talking about?
Well, in the case of a synchronous generator, one designed to connect to the grid, in America you have 60 hertz, and in Australia we have 50 hertz, so we're talking 60 revolutions per second in America. So obviously, if the diameter of the rotor, for writing a second, is 1 meter, multiply that by pi, and you've got 3 1/7, and you multiply by that 60, you've got about 200 meters per second. The design speed would be set for that, the points, the sharp edges, and so forth, would be probably machined for that operation. If you want to go to 500 meters per second, you'd have a larger disc. If you want to go non-grid synchronous, of course, the disc can shrink, and in the case of the universal RTG operating from compressed air, that's operating at about 40,000 RPM. With a certainly high speed, but they are well within the capabilities of machine shops, engineering facilities. Of course, all these things say that when you've got a G-force at the outer tip of the rotor of 100,000 Gs, the rotor has to be well manufactured. It has to be balanced. It's not something for somebody to do in the backyard. We're talking about specialized machine shops. But still, computer CNC equipment and balancing techniques are commonly used in turbine industry and so forth exist. So the technology challenges are small, although it shouldn't be understated. They do require precision and care.
Also, talking about the input energy requirement, even though the rotor itself and the magnetic bearings and the vacuum in there to prevent drag is going to make it so that it itself is not producing a lot of friction, the whatever's making it turn is going to be going through a lot of work to be spinning that fast. And there's going to be heat and whatnot created on that end of things, and there's going to be a lot of, you know, that's a specialty piece of equipment to be able to keep a device like this spinning at that speed.
No, not at all. In terms of the vacuum, it's not the vacuum is obtained. The usual practice is to install getters, and get it simply scavenge the vacuum enclosure. But I don't imagine if properly manufactured with proper vacuum sealed that it will lose vacuum within 10 years. And if it does, it's just a question of repumping. As far as heat losses in magnetic bearings, of course, there is no losses in magnetic bearings. There's a small amount of energy required to operate the magnetic bearings. But again, this is like thrust to drag ratios and lift to drag ratios. Magnetic bearings at the center, whilst the tip of the disc may be traveling at 500 meters per second, the actual bearing area is only operating at a hundredth of that. So there's just no issue there. There is no loss from bearings that is worth noting. There's no loss from friction in the vacuum. All of these things might come down to a fraction of 1% of the total power generated. But friction itself, of course, is a heat-generating process, and again, the device runs on heat. So if there were any friction, it would simply be recycled back into the disc. So the bottom line is that a device that has heat coming in and doesn't require a heat exhaust can only be 100% efficient, irrespective of whether the bearings were to consume 10% of the energy.
Now, also, let's clarify, the primary output product here that's being generated is not torque, but electricity, correct?
The output is torque. It is shaft horsepower. It is the torque that results from a large amount of current flowing from the unit to the outer disc, crossing over a magnetic field, which is running from top to bottom as you look at the disc, as the disc is spinning on a horizontal surface. So it's torque. It is absolutely torque. And in the designs I've got on the website, you see at the central spindle area, there's actual fact a magnetic coupling, sort of a magnet rod within a magnet cylinder, and it transfers across a glass barrier, so the vacuum is preserved on the inside and at the inside the chamber. On the outside, where the shaft is going to a generic generator, that's the smallest diameter, and that, of course, is even there. But at the RPM we're talking about, again, that's a minuscule loss. But all of these things are not an issue. The issues with this device, if there is one, is that it's unproved. It's unproved. It's not in the textbooks. I talked to hundreds and hundreds of people, physicists, professors, and the general viewpoint is, gosh, there's been anything like it before. Brilliant. That's where we're at. And for me to profess that there can be no problems, of course, would be naive. But from a general engineering point of view, there's no issue with the couplings, there's no issue with the vacuum, there's no issues with the energy in, the energy out, the stability. There's just no issue. The only issue is, will it work?
Okay. I apologize. I'm still having a hard time wrapping my head around. And part of the problem here, too, is your voice coming through the line is distorted quite a bit. I guess the number of fish you have to go through from Australia to the United States is quite a few or whatever. But I'm not catching all your words and also your accents. A little bit difficult for me to understand, though, you know, we do speak the same language. So there's a few obstacles to prevent me from understanding fully what you're describing here. I had thought earlier in your description that the purpose of rotation was to create basically electrons coming off the perimeter of the rotation, and that you were harvesting electrons, therefore electrical energy. But now, if I understand right, you're telling me that the output is torque. You're spinning this on one end with some kind of a motor to make it spin very fast, and as a function of the process, there's a tremendous additional amount of torque that is created. Help me understand which scenario we're talking about, because I'm very confused.
Well, yeah, you've managed to offer me two scenarios, neither one of which I can agree with. I'll restate it. I'm not harvesting electrons. The spinning rotor, and let's just say, take it back, it's got up to speed. We've had a motor that got the thing up to speed. It's now running at speed, and because it's running with tremendous G-force at the edge, hot electrons, fermionic electrons, are able to jump off the disk. When they jump off their disk, they arrive into space cold. They've used all their energy. That's the important thing. They've used their heat energy to create in the disk a deficit of charge. The disk has become positive in the region that the electrons escape from. At the outer edge of the disk, we now have lots of vacated spots in the metal with a positive charge. That means that that disk wants to pull electrons from within the metal, from the inside of the disk, wants to pull in electrons to get back to neutral. So the harvest of electrons, as you were saying, in actual fact, those are the ones that are sitting in space. Now, we just want them to return back to the center of the disk, and we'll use those electrons as the replacement electrons for themselves. So there's a current going to be flowing through from the inside of the disk to the outside of the disk, caused by the charge created by the electrons escaping. That is where the heat has been converted to. It's been converted to an EMF, to a voltage. When an electron then passes past the magnetic field, it causes a torque in the disk, making the disk want to turn faster. The disk itself, coupled to the outside world via a magnetic coupled shaft, and it drives the standard AC generator, or in the case of the universal RTG, it drives a compressor, and on the output side of the air, an expansion turbine also is on the same shaft to drive the compressor. It's sort of simple, and yet it's a bit confounding, because the thing that everybody has to get their mind around is, in thermionics, it's the electrons do their job, not because they're electrons, but because they have left behind a positive charge. They have used their kinetic energy to launch themselves, so a bit like a rocket, but launch themselves into space. They've got into orbit. They're already into deep space. They've got no energy left. They're completely spent. But what they did in leaving was to leave behind a big positive charge, a hole. And that positive charge hole is capable of sucking in a replacement electron from within the metal. Does that help you, Sterling?
I'm picking up bits and pieces here, but I still am, and we may have to, that's fine that we go through this entire segment and I don't understand. The purpose of this is for you to be able to explain your concept to other people who maybe have a better capacity to be able to understand. So the objective here is not so that I can understand the situation. It's to give you a chance to tell your story, what you've got, how it works, where it's going, and what it could do in solving the world's energy crisis, and what sectors it can address. So let's not belabor too much, because maybe I'm just dense on this one, and we'll just have to pass with that. You did go through a description on our site, and it does have some analogous scenarios that people who have studied those scenarios, the homopolar and the Faraday disk, people who are familiar with those will go, oh yeah, I know exactly what he's doing. And apparently, as we passed this by the New Energy Congress, two or three people did just that. And so that's, why we have been giving this attention. Let's talk for a minute about the business end of things. You've got this idea, and you have a website. You've been trying to get universities to pay some attention. You have gotten a few people to take notice. Let's talk about one or two of those. There's a professor, if I understand right, who has looked at this carefully and has said, you've got something here. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, well, the first thing we did in Australia is that we got in touch with a billionaire, and the billionaire being a billionaire, of course, didn't get there by throwing his money around too easily. And he said, I have a science advisor. He claimed, in particular, I'll just call him Dr. Ben, was Australia's best scientist, and he said he wanted to give it to the scientist, and the scientist would then come back, and if the scientist said it will go up, and the billionaire would invest. The Dr. Ben took it away and was traveling to Europe and so forth. He looked at it, he came back, and after 2 months, he beat me up, and he said, I cannot fault it. And he said, close words, and nobody else in the world will fault it. You have to simply build it. And then came the next day, the billionaire spoke to me, and the billionaire said, right, you will do it my way. And I said, hang on a second. I'll do it my way. It's got to be for the benefit of mankind, but it's not to make you a trillionaire. And so the billionaire and I fell out very quickly. And after that, it's a sudden realization that there are not too many billionaires that want to listen to people. And in fact, since that point in time, we found that the door was shut. As far as other professors go, there is a professor in the USA, in fact, a couple, one whose pet subject is the violatable nature of the second law. He's looked at this a number of times and given me lots of words of encouragement. But his viewpoint is that nobody will believe it until you build one. So we had a situation that nobody will believe it until you build one. And therefore, how do you get funding? Because nobody will believe it. Taking, for instance, the Australian government, we had in Australia a minister, a guy that was represented, and he acts, his area of expertise or power is the environment, climate change, and there's another minister that operates in the energy and water. And I wrote to these ministers saying, can I sit down with you? And they refused to give me the chance, despite my putting forward lots and lots of evidence that there is merit in the ideas and so forth, and telling them everything I have to tell them and so forth. They still refused to talk to me. I've written to the Prime Minister, the President, if you will, of Australia, complaining that the ministers won't even sit down and talk to me. Well, he hasn't responded. I've written to 100 or 1,000 newspapers, I guess a few hundred, and saying, I've got a story that needs to be told. Not one of them will come back and talk to me. The fact of the matter is the world needs a miracle to save itself. And the fact of the matter is that anyone that offers a miracle must be mad. the very definition of what we need puts anybody that has a solution into the, you should ignore this person. So we have a situation that if the world recognizes a miracle is needed, that is going to treat everyone that says they have a solution as mad, the miracle will never come to surface. I do not absolutely know whether this device will work. I say it's 50-50. It's 50-50 because everything I have done to try and find somebody that can find a flaw, I've offered a cash prize, no one can find a flaw. I can't find a flaw. I spent 2 years before I even went public because it was so radical, because the hallowed second law of thermodynamics, which I was taught at university, I respected so much, I believe it had to be a mistake. Now, I spent thousands and thousands of hours just on the philosophy of the subject. I do not believe it's a mistake, but if it's 50-50 and you're 53 years of age, do you sell your house and everything? Could you try and prove it? Or do you say, I'm giving this to the world. Why shouldn't the world pay for development costs? I'm not asking the world to pay me any money. I'm simply asking the world to fund the rotor. The Department of Energy in the USA, Arnold Schwarzenegger come in from California, say, we do it. Somebody somewhere to do it. Who's going to do it for the benefit of mankind, not for the benefit of their own pockets? The testimonies in the world will not change the fact that 99.99% of conventional university professors won't touch this with a 10-foot pole because it's the emperor's new clothing. And if you say you believe in it, you might find that you're asked to resign. That's the problem. That's why I won't name Dr. Ben or Professor Ben. Two of my strongest proofs that academia, established academia, believe in it. But by the same token, they don't want to be named. If the device worked, it's probably be the first people to say, I knew it was going to work, but at this point in time, no one's prepared to say anything.
How much money are we talking about to build a prototype to demonstrate this concept?
With a two-tier thing, if all the equipment was already available, high vacuum pumps and so forth, measuring equipment and so forth, it could be as little as $50,000. it could be as much as $500,000. If all the equipment had to be obtained, that figure would obviously go from a couple of $100,000 up to $1 million. But the reason I give a higher upper limit is there's too much unknown about building a proof of concept. I mean, for the world to back it, it has to power a reasonable load, 100-watt light bulb per month. None of this, oh yes, we can just detect some slight amount of bulb unity. It has to be absolutely unambiguous. A light bulb must brightly shine, guarded by security people, looked upon by the President of the United States, the Congress, or whatever sort of thing, a whole bunch of witnesses, TV stations, press gallery. It has to be absolute. And so we have to make sure that we have the device up to that level before we go to take off the commercialization. So it might be the case that $50,000 might get us to an academic proof of concept. But an absolute proof of concept that the world will not question may cost 10 times that. However, I would say this, that the academic proof of concept would be sufficient to know whether we should go for the big proof of concept. I don't think it has to necessarily be done in one stage. I think it should be done in two stages. A rotor made and spun at very high speeds and measured by a collection of scientists in a recognized laboratory, MIT, whatever. And the results of that then go to a meeting, a discussion group, and so forth, and then it's set down to produce a unit that will give a demonstration that the world will open its eyes to. It's a miracle.
Right. Now, in terms of the intellectual property end of things, you sent me a document yesterday that was a series of drawings for a patent. Was that something that was filed, or was that in preparation to file?
That was in preparation to file. We've filed some other documents since then, some provisional documents. But the position as far as intellectual property goes, that the device for the domestic production of power is free to the world. Anybody in the world can make one. When we know enough about the exact sharpness of points and so forth, that will be public, be no secrecy. As far as devices for cars or aeroplanes go, we're holding a right of license on that because it's our viewpoint. If everything was given to the world for free, the one people in the world that would be hurt the most would be the third world, because they wouldn't have access to tractors that run on fresh air. They wouldn't have access to free fertilizer and so forth. And so, the West would stop needing the third world agricultural countries, who, after all, can produce a vast amount of food, but only can do so with the assistance of the buying of America and Europe and so forth to enable them to have diesel for their tractors and fertilizers for the food. So what we want to do is we want to sort of say, look, anybody can have electricity for free. Nobody should have to pay any license, royalty or whatever to have an electric fire on at home, to listen to the record fire, whatever sort of thing. But industry should pay a very small amount of money as a license fee. So in other words, for every motor car, every auto that leaves the factory, there may be $1,000 charge. There's a royalty which will be applied to the third world nation so that they can afford to buy built generators. That's our only condition, is that there has to be some balancing of the situation in favor of the third world.
Now, in terms of cost, when we talk about free energy, and we use that term freely at freeenergynews.com, pezwiki.com, and we use it to refer to the source of energy. Solar energy is free. Wind is free. You don't pay a thing for it. It's there. Geothermal, tide. You're just harvesting this ubiquitous, pervasive energy source, but the machines themselves are anything but free that harvest that energy. Solar energy is free, but solar panels are not free. They're very expensive compared to other sources of energy. That gap is narrowing. Solar is becoming more affordable as certain new approaches come along. But in terms of a cents per kilowatt hour, Do you have any idea about how much your unit will cost to manufacture? It's not a simple unit. It's got some highly sophisticated, very high tolerances required. You know, magnetic bearings, those aren't cheap. So the device itself is not going to be, you know, below a few thousand dollars. How much is the, you know, the I guess they say dollar per watt installed in the wind industry, for example, that you've got, and then you've got the maintenance costs. So how much are we to compare your device to, say, a solar or a wind situation? How many dollars per watt output of the end product are we talking about to build one of your devices? Have you run those kinds of numbers?
Yes, and in fact, you know, part of that equation is the cost of financing as well. Running the whole thing, if you will, through a spreadsheet, you sort of said, well, let's say take a 50 kilowatt device at $20,000. We believe that that will have an almost limitless life. Maintenance maybe every 5 or 10 years, but basically it's the financing cost. If you have to borrow $20,000 at 5%, it's going to cost you $1,000 a year. And the 50 kilowatt unit running for, you just said 20 hours a day, maybe somebody using 1,000 kilowatt day, 365,000 kilowatts a year, and you've got $1,000 cost, that means that each kilowatt is 1/365th of a dollar. A third of a cent, allowing for maintenance and so forth, allowing for the thing eventually to fail somehow. It's not going to change that very much. So my estimation for a mature product is fractional cent cost. Initial cost probably more realistically around the 4 cents per kilowatt hour. However, I mean it's certainly going to come in a 50 kilowatt unit for $20,000. Is only 40 cents per installed kilowatt as opposed to the magical dollar per installed kilowatt, which everyone talks about. So it's way cheaper than the coal-fired power stations, way cheaper than wind power. It's way cheaper than solar because solar doesn't have the efficiency. Mind you, might I say that in the case of solar, this device, if you wanted to not include the compressor and the expansion turbine, the universal RTG is designed to accept solar input. And so if you have a large solar concentration system and you believe that, for argument's sake, the cost per kilowatt of collector can be down at 20 cents a kilowatt using some very, very cheap technology, probably not existing, but if you could, then the device itself, for argument's sake, a multi-hundred kilowatt or even megawatt device, probably for $50,000 to $100,000 could be conceived, and that is certainly a lot better than the photovoltaic concentrators or the Stirling engines or steam engines and so forth that are put on the end of solar concentrators. Well, their efficiency, of course, is always the problem, because if you've got tremendous solar collection areas and you only get 30% efficiency from your generation, using three times as much collectors as you otherwise would want. So it's an enabling technology, also for geothermal. In the case of Australia and America and certainly Mexico, there's vast amounts of thermal energy in geothermal. And if a device was built which accepted temperatures of say, you know, 300, 500 degrees centigrade, it wouldn't require the generic compressor, it wouldn't require the expansion turbine. And it would be capable of a relatively modest size unit, perhaps the size of a water tank. Would be talking about multiple megawatts, and I would imagine a manufactured cost of probably $500,000 for multiple megawatts. So again, it probably comes down to 25 cents, 50 cents per installed kilowatt.
Yeah, I was just asking you about the cost of this. If you've done some calculations, because obviously free energy, though the source is free, solar, wind, are free for the taking, but the devices that harness that energy are not free. And in this wind industry, we talk about the capitalization costs, dollar per watt, to build a 3-megawatt device, for example. How much does it cost? Have you run those numbers on your in your projections for your technology?
Yes, I'm not really very sure. We got cut off, but yes, we have, and we certainly estimate less than 50 cents per installed kilowatt. And in terms of continuous electricity production, we're approximately 1 cent per kilowatt hour. That's taking into account the initial cost of the unit, the financing cost, if you will, the maintenance and the lifetime of the unit. So it's certainly way lower than any conventional technology. And the device also, of course, can be married with geothermal energy and solar concentrator energy. And because its efficiency is 100%, then in the case of solar collection, it's reducing the total amount of, if you will, mirrors or whatever, to a third of what's presently required, simply on the basis of its higher efficiency. So a 50 kilowatt unit for $20,000, and that produces some hundreds of thousands of kilowatt hours per year. If a $20,000 unit is financed with, say, 5% interest, $1,000 per year, let's say you've got to pay back the principal, so let's call it, double that, we're still looking at a fraction of a cent per kilowatt hour. Worst case, 1 cent per kilowatt hour. Amazingly cheap.
Another thing we've not addressed is, even though you're saying that this could run on ambient temperature, room temperature, to drive it, is it heat dependent, meaning that if you increase the heat, you get more power, if you decrease the heat, you get less power? And what would happen, low temperature versus high temperature? Let's say you're driving in the winter with the same device that you drive in the summer. How is that going to change the output signature?
Absolutely. It will work in the Arctic, but let's just say a device designed for California working in the Arctic might produce 1 kilowatt as opposed to 2 kilowatts or 3 kilowatts in LA. And certainly in the Sahara, you might get 5 kilowatts out of it. So there's a lot of advantages of working on a non-compressor version in a warmer climate. However, when you start talking about compressor version, it is not an issue. You simply raise the compression ratio up to the temperature that you want for the radiated transfer to the much smaller rotor. And because of the 100% efficiency, all it really means is that instead of doing 2 cubic meters per second, you might do 3 cubic meters per second. So in answer, the simple unit, the one that doesn't have compressors and so forth, will have variance. And because the thermodynamic effect is an exponential thing, temperature is significant. Not so much the thermodynamic, but the radiative heat transfer is a fourth power. Obviously, if you drop from 457 watts per square meter at 300 K down to 250 K, where you seemingly only have dropped a small amount in percentage-wise, but in actual fact, when taken to the fourth power, it starts looking like half. So operating at below freezing temperature, you're probably talking about half or less power output. That's, as I say, well, if that's the case, you have bigger unit, or you go to a compressor version, the universal RTG with compressor and expansion turbine.
Back to the question of building the first prototype, you're saying it could be as low as $50,000. How much time do you think that would take to build the first unit?
2 months.
How much time would it take?
2 months from somebody saying, here's the university, here's the equipment, here's the machine shop. I'd be on airplane to wherever it is, and 2 months.
3 months? Also, we are at the end of the time, but we've not given your website. Let's get your website address.
That's the issue. As long as the machine shop can do what's required, that's the big issue.
Okay. We're wrapping up the show here, and we haven't given your address out for your website. Do you want to give us that?
It's studyonrevolution.com. But I'm perfectly happy for the readers to go to the page wiki Power Wikipedia sites, because that has got more up-to-date and accurate words, although they're not fully formed. The other website is, if you will, it's a bit blurry, it's a bit short, it's a bit low on technical detail. Because it's a concept that needs to be gotten over to people of a wide range of scientific knowledge. But the site, your page wiki site, is slowly developing into a much more complete debate or a dissertation.
Okay. So over at PESWiki, PESWIKI.com, people can enter in thermionic generator, thermionic, and they'll get more information about this. Again, Phil, we thank you for coming on the show, and we certainly wish you the best in going forward with this.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to get the debate going.
You bet.
Cheers, Australia.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.